Welcome to the Cello Sherpa podcast, where we explore all aspects of the climb to the summit from intermediate musician to the professional stage. Check us out online at thecellosherpa.com or follow us on Instagram or Threads at thecellosherpa. I'm Joel Dallow, your host. I joined the cello section of the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra in 1999 and founded the Riverside Chamber Players based in Roswell, Georgia in 2003. If you're looking for a bit of extra help on learning your orchestra or solo repertoire, perhaps we can help. Visit www.thecellosherpa.com and drop us a line. We offer virtual or in-person lessons. Today's episode is sponsored by Clear Resources, your premier resource for compliance, legal, ethics, and risk. For more information, visit them online at clearresources.com. Today's guest is violinist Robin Bollinger, who made her Philadelphia Orchestra debut at 12 years old. She is the newly appointed concertmaster of the Detroit Symphony Orchestra. Thank you so much for joining us today on the Cello Sherpa podcast.
It's my pleasure. Nice to be here.
So I've known you since you were 3 years old. I was friends with your parents and first met your mom, Jerry, when I was freelancing in the Philadelphia area. Your mom's a violist and your dad, Blair, is the bass trombonist of the Philadelphia Orchestra. I always marveled at your playing from right when you started. You seemed so natural, and it was obvious to me by the time you were 12 years old that you were going to accomplish big things. And boy, have you. You were only 12 when you made your debut with the Philadelphia Orchestra. Can you tell us how that came about?
Well, goodness, thank you. Yeah, so actually, when I was a kid, I would always participate in the Philadelphia Orchestra Youth Concerto Competition, which sadly doesn't exist anymore, but it was a mainstay of my schedule as a kid. It was the Albert M. Greenfield Competition. Everybody in the area did it, and they had different divisions. And so I think I first participated when I was 7, and then eventually I won when I was 11. And so then the following year, I got to solo with the Philadelphia Orchestra. I played Sarah Sigourneyweisen. And then actually the next year, the next category, I was in the junior category, so I was allowed to compete again. And I won that too. So I got to come back and play two movements of Prokofiev G minor concerto with the orchestra 2 years later. So that was a pretty crazy ride.
Yeah. And I remember when I think you were 13, you guys came down to Atlanta and your dad conducted you with the Covington Symphony, which is where he grew up, and you played the Mozart violin concerto.
That sounds right. I think so. Yeah.
Yeah. And I remember that's where I was really blown away. I was like, wow, it's amazing that you could play so well at that age. I could tell it was obvious to me you were headed on a pretty serious track. Did you know at that point that you wanted to become a professional musician?
Yeah. I always joke that I was really boring and it just never occurred to me to do anything else. You know, playing the violin was just kind of always it. But I think also that was just part of growing up, that my parents were both musicians, my parents' friends, like you, were all musicians. So like the people I was surrounded by were all musicians. And so I think I was embarrassingly old by the time I figured out you could do something else. And by then I was hooked. So it was too late.
Yeah, I was going to say, so getting that opportunity to solo with the Philadelphia Orchestra, not once, but twice, that must have really given you the bug. You got bitten right then. And
oh my gosh.
So when you were that age and you were thinking, I want to be a professional musician, what did that look like to you as a career? I mean, your parents were both playing in orchestra. Your mom was subbing regularly. So what did you envision would be your path?
I was such a little diva. I wanted to be a soloist. Uh-huh. I loved coming to the orchestra and watching the violin soloists. That was always my dream and the goal. And that's why I loved these competitions that I would do and these opportunities, because it was like preparing me for the big thing. But I will say, actually, when I was a kid, the Philadelphia Orchestra hired their new concertmaster, David Kim, who's now been concertmaster for, I think, close to 30 years.
Yeah.
And I remember when he came and he became sort of a mentor of mine. And I remember him telling me fairly early, like, you might think about being a concertmaster. Have you thought about being a concertmaster? Mm-hmm. Talking about what a concertmaster does. So even though being a soloist was always this overarching ideal, being a concertmaster was always closely linked with that dream as another avenue.
Okay. So When you were that age, do you remember feeling nervous or were you just super excited because this is really what you wanted to do?
As a kid, I was just excited. It wasn't until college that I started actually getting nervous. I mean, and certainly I would be excited and, you know, the adrenaline would be pumping, but there was no fear. It was just joy and like chomping at the bit, let me at him.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, when I got to college, it became more real. All of a sudden, there were expectations and the possibility of failure.
Yeah.
And that's really scary. So college was the time for me to grapple with nerves. Yeah. But as a kid, I was really lucky.
Yeah. I was going to say, though, that must have been hard then. It's like if you spend your whole life eating whatever you want and then all of a sudden you can't anymore.
Yeah.
So you spent all this time playing and no nerves and then suddenly they come later. You must have had to figure out how to manage through that.
Yeah. And it was a real sort of identity crisis because it was something that people would always marvel at that like, oh, you don't get nervous. And I'd be like, no, I don't get nervous. And so all of a sudden here I was and I was nervous and I was like, oh my gosh, what do I do with this? Am I cut out for this? What does this mean? And so figuring out how to channel my nerves and address them and work through them was something I worked really hard at.
Yeah, I can imagine. I found that for me, I feel like performance anxiety in a way has gotten worse as I've gotten older and more experienced because I've had more experiences where I know what can go wrong. So the more that those have piled up in my past, the more nervous it makes me because I know what can happen. So you think the more you play, the easier it gets. But for me, I guess it's been the opposite.
You know, I totally get that. And I think the flip side of that for me is that, yep, I've like seen all these things go wrong. And you know what? I'm still standing. So if it doesn't kill you, it makes you stronger, right?
Yeah. I used to freelance with a colleague in the Philadelphia area who once said, well, it's not like when you make a mistake, you nick an artery and kill the patient. It's all about keeping it in perspective.
Yes, that's exactly what my teacher in college, Miriam Fried, used to say. She was like, look, if you mess up, nobody dies. So like, you mess up, you take a bow, you go home, you try again tomorrow. It's not rocket science. It's not brain surgery. Everybody's going to be okay, including you.
Yeah, that's true.
The other thing that she used to tell me was that if you're not nervous, it means you don't care. And if you don't care, why are you doing this?
Yeah.
And I found that really empowering, that it's a way to say, this is a manifestation of my commitment to what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. The fact that I care about this so much that it puts me on edge really is a sign of strength. Kind of.
Yeah.
you can talk yourself into anything. So.
Yeah. And I've also heard people say that they get more nervous if they don't feel nervous.
Right.
Because they get used to that feeling and they've figured out how to channel that energy. And if they're not nervous, maybe they're not as focused as they need to be. So
right.
There are so many different ways we can spin it in our mind. It's all about that mental training, I think, is such a big part of it.
The last thing that I'll tell you about nerves is that through college, I sort of figured it out and got more comfortable. Later, I started going to the Marlboro Music Festival, which is, you know, famous, famous jazz music festival. And the pressure on those performances is intense because, I mean, everybody who you've ever heard of has been to Marlboro. And so, like, you know, you're going to perform. And it's this huge weight of history and expectations. And I used to get so nervous about being nervous.
Yeah.
Like, I would be nervous ahead of time that I would be too nervous in the concert to play well. And, like, that is a brutal spiral. And it's another way of saying the anxiety about the thing is worse than actually doing the thing. Usually by the time I got out on stage, I actually felt okay.
Yeah.
So remembering that you just got to move through it. Yep, it's there and it's going to be okay.
Yeah. And people think I'm crazy, but I actually gave up caffeine for that reason.
Yeah.
Because the sitting around ahead of time with caffeine enhanced my nerves so much that it was not a benefit.
Yes.
So, and then once I learned to live without it, I felt better actually without it. And I haven't gone back in about 9 years to it. But
it
really made a difference to performance anxiety.
Yeah.
So you've had a really varied career until you became Concertmaster of Detroit.
Yeah.
You were doing all kinds of different things. Can you talk a little bit about what those things were and how they prepared you for your current role?
Sure. So before I moved to Detroit, I was living in Boston and I was freelancing. I was doing a lot of solo playing. I was doing a lot of recitals, a lot of solos with orchestra. I was doing a lot of chamber music, and I was doing a lot of teaching. I was on faculty at Newbury Conservatory Prep, and I was teaching at Brandeis University and other places around. I think my claim to fame, if you will, in Boston was that I did these multimedia recital projects. And I started these actually when I was still in school, because I'm really passionate about making classical music more accessible to broader audiences and bringing people to this art. And so for me, I know I feel more connected to a performance when I know something personal, whether it's like I know the performer, or I can relate to the story of the composer, or I have experience with this piece, whether I've played it or just listened to it a million times. Having that kind of personal in made classical music wonderful for me. And I wanted to do that for anyone. So I developed these multimedia recital projects that were all about storytelling. So the first multimedia project was about Paganini. It was all 24 Paganini caprices and interspersed throughout the program.
Wow.
Yeah. Interspersed throughout the program was the story of Paganini's life, so his biography, but also the context of his time and what his art meant in his era and what it means to us today, and providing this story of this remarkable man. And then after school, I did a project that was all about chaconnes. So it's telling the story of the chaconne, the story of this musical form through violin repertoire. And of course, at the center of that program is the famous Bach chaconne for solo violin. So that project earned me an enormous grant from the Lenore Annenberg Fellowship Fund. And I was very fortunate to be able to record that program. I made a CD and a DVD and then gave a national tour of the program. So that kind of put me on the map in a different way for solo and recital stuff.
Yeah.
And was really exciting and a ton of work. And I loved it. But I was traveling all the time and was kind of looking for more of a home base, a little more stability.
Well, before we get into that, I have a couple questions. So
yeah,
going back to the Paganini project, so you played all 24 caprices in one program?
Yeah, and spoke.
So tell me logistically how that worked. Did you set up a screen that you had a projector that you were doing multimedia? How exactly did that program lay out for the audience?
Yeah, exactly that. So basically, I made a series of short documentaries, and they would play kind of like program notes. They would play interspersed throughout the program. So there was no actual printed program because I wanted everyone to be engaged with what was happening on stage. But yeah, each of these little documentaries would play. So I'd play like three caprices or four caprices, and then there'd be a short 3-minute video. Mm-hmm. And then I would speak live about something personal, like what this aspect of Paganini's life or this aspect of his history meant to me and maybe to the audience. And so we would do that 6 times.
Yeah.
So that was the Paganini format. And then chaconne was very similar. But since there were only 4 pieces on the program, each piece got its own little prelude video, if you will. So the program was Biber Passacaglia, which predates the Bach chaconne by about 50 years. Bach chaconne, first movement of Bartok solo sonata, which is sort of an homage to the Bach chaconne, and Berio Sequenza, which was written in 1976 and is modeled after the Bach chaconne. So it was sort of a profile of each of these composers and talking about the chaconne form and what it meant to each of them.
Wow, what a cool idea. I mean, I ran a chamber music series for 17 years, and I remember when I started it.
That's right.
I told the critic that I was going to have a question and answer period in the middle of the concert. And he said, What? Who does that? I said, well, I want to do it because what I felt, I feel like I was aligned in a way with what you're talking about, although way less technical. I always wanted to introduce the pieces to the audience. I wanted the programs to be 75 minutes without an intermission so that they left feeling like they wanted more instead of feeling like they heard too much.
Yep.
I wanted it to feel like we were having a concert in someone's living room in the 1700s or 1800s, like bring it back to just up close and personal, ask questions, keep it more casual, because I feel like there's this barrier that we have in classical music that a lot of people feel like they don't even want to go to a concert because they don't understand what they're listening to. So I wanted to knock that wall down and give people an opportunity to hear things in a way that they didn't need to know what they were listening to.
Yeah.
And it sounds like you took that a lot farther, so which is so cool. So tell me, how long were your programs?
Yeah, exactly what you're describing, 75 minutes.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah.
And then did people have a chance to engage with you in the program, or did that come afterwards?
That came afterwards. So I would do a Q&A afterwards. No, but the program itself, I mean, it's such an athletic event to do something like that, especially because this repertoire that I was choosing was really hard.
Yeah.
And so I needed to kind of keep my head completely in the zone. And so I wanted, yeah, control over that time. And then I could open it up afterwards, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. Did you handle the actual logistics? Like, you had to deal with the computer also? Or did you have somebody that was helping you when you were doing that?
Usually I had somebody helping me.
Okay.
Because then there was also like dealing with the lights, because in order to see the screen, the lights have to be down. But if the lights are down, then you can't see me. And it kind of required one other person. I think I did it once without, but I may have blocked it out. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. Has anybody else done programs like this? Or sounds like it's so revolutionary, which is why you were able to get a big grant and do it all over the country.
Yeah.
Do you know if anybody else has modeled a program after this or taken your idea? Or did you find some inspiration from somebody else's program that helped pave the way?
This started because I honestly love Paganini and I wanted to convince my friends that Paganini is like worthwhile music, not just really hard.
Yeah.
So it became this story that I figured out how to tell. I have heard of some other multimedia recital projects recently, but to be honest with you, no names are jumping to mind. So like, I know that people are doing them and I haven't seen any, and I don't know if they're exactly like what I did.
Yeah.
I will also tell you that I started another one. So right before COVID, I was in residence at Dumbarton Oaks Museum, the famous Dumbarton Oaks Museum that Stravinsky wrote his piece for, which is in DC. And they had me down there for a semester. It was like a semester long residency to develop my next multimedia program. So that was going to be all about encores.
Mm-hmm.
So I spent a couple of months doing a ton of research at the Library of Congress and have a version of the program ready to go, but it needs some tweaking. But that's what I was doing right before COVID. And then COVID hit and, you know, the world turned upside down. And so encores is still on the back burner.
Yeah, that sounds really cool though. Okay, so then let's talk about your path to becoming concertmaster. You never had an orchestra job before this, correct?
That's right.
Did you take any auditions before this one?
I took one other blind audition before I won the Detroit audition, but that was it.
Wow.
But I will say I had been doing a lot of guest concertmaster work. So I had been invited to play as concertmaster with the Pittsburgh Symphony, with the Indianapolis Symphony, and was talking with a couple other orchestras. So it was something that I had a little bit of experience doing and something that I enjoyed and people seemed to think I was good at. So it wasn't totally out of the blue, but it wasn't something that I had pursued myself really until Detroit.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you were looking for some stability in your life also. And that seed that David Kim had planted so long ago had sprouted and was ready for you to go on to this next step that you sort of had in the back of your mind all this time as something you may pursue.
Yeah.
That's really cool. So has there been a steep learning curve for you, or has it been a pretty natural feeling transition?
Sure. Both. I mean, you know, I think being a concertmaster is so much about the community that you're in and what does your community expect from you and what does your community need from you? Because I think ultimately that's what leadership is working with people. But then there's also just the nuts and bolts, learning the repertoire, learning how to make effective bowings, learning when to ask questions and when to be quiet. All of those things just take experience, which is another way of saying it just takes making mistakes.
Yeah. That's true. We all learn from our mistakes.
Yeah. But yeah, so I mean, I wasn't starting from zero because of all the guest concertmaster work that I have done. But I will say I'm also so grateful to my colleagues. They've been so encouraging and supportive. I really trust my community here and they're learning to trust me. And that's really exciting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So what skill that you picked up along the way with all these other projects that you were doing do you think most prepared you for this giant position?
Yeah. You know, I remember David telling me when I got serious about auditions, he said, you are going to need every experience you've ever had to be concertmaster. And he's so totally right. He's like, anytime you've just like picked up the violin and played for somebody in your living room, anytime you've soloed with orchestra, anytime you've had a difficult conversation, like all of those things support the preparation for being concertmaster. One aspect of my career that you and I haven't talked about yet was in Boston, I was in a conductorless chamber orchestra called A Far Cry. And we were democratically run, which meant that we did everything ourselves. And so I had a lot of experience playing concertmaster with A Far Cry, but also we were self-run. So I had experience running our youth competitions. And, you know, I was co-chair of the education committee. I served on the board for a little while. So I was the clerk. So I took all the minutes. So, you know, lots of other skills that go into being a concertmaster, you know, liaising with the board and working closely with our staff. And, you know, with Far Cry, we had meetings all the time to discuss programming and all of our rehearsals were discussion based. So
yeah,
I think that experience really helped me prepare for the varied skill set that you need as a concertmaster.
Yeah, that makes sense because it is a different role probably than any other role in the orchestra. I mean, obviously we have a lot of principals and there's that same responsibility that you have as principal of a section, but you're really kind of the leader next to the conductor of the whole string section and whole orchestra, the liaison really to the music director. And as we were talking about, it requires an incredible amount of leadership. And I'm curious as to what you would say the qualities are that are necessary to be an effective leader.
Oh my gosh. I just spoke to some students about this earlier this week and boy, some traits. Let's see. I think patience, generosity, empathy. I mean, we're all people. And yes, the stakes are high and the standards are high, but sometimes people have a migraine and, you know, or sometimes people have a sick kid and, or a sick parent, and just knowing what's going on in people's lives so that I can support them effectively. You know, that doesn't mean that I need to be their therapist and it doesn't mean I need to know the details, but just to know there's something going on and to give people the space or the support. I like to check in with people in the break and rehearsal, like, I'll go to the back of the section and be like, what do you guys need? How's it going? Do you have any questions? Is there anything you need from me? Mm-hmm. So yeah, being a leader takes vigilance in that way. Another thing that I think about a lot as a leader is how can I let other people shine? As concertmaster, I'm the most visible member of the orchestra, right? Literally, my face is on the side of the building. I get, you know, my own bow when I walk out. That's a ton of quote unquote glory, right? For one person.
Yeah.
But the orchestra is a team and I have really amazing colleagues. And so trying to give them opportunities to be heard and be appreciated. I think about this, especially with our committee work, some of the offstage work, that I'm really aware that if I'm speaking, someone else is not speaking. And I have that platform in rehearsal on stage to be heard. And so how can I make room for other people elsewhere? Yeah, I guess it's a global look at the organization.
Well, then this skill set to be in that position of leadership, not just the logistical side of things and stage and obviously being well prepared for the very first rehearsal, because people are going to look to you to possibly demonstrate things. And you've also had to put in all the bowings, which then works their way through the rest of the principals in the orchestra. So it's a huge responsibility. The leadership side of it that you're talking about, being a human being, which I think is a really refreshing way to approach leadership. Did this come naturally to you, or have you had to work at it and do some of your own research to figure out what's the best style?
I think both. And there are many different kinds of leadership. You know, I was teaching for years. Being a teacher is being a leader. In A Far Cry, my chamber orchestra, I would lead rehearsals or I would have to fight for an idea in a meeting. That's leadership. So it was stuff that I definitely had experience with or had an instinct for. And I will say, after my first season this past summer, I gave myself a leadership course. It's like, okay, I know I'm doing some things and I know some things are working. I want to know why they're working. I want to know what else I can do. So I read a couple books and started listening to some podcasts to really make this a more conscious part of my process and a more conscious part of my style.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, I mean, you touched on, yeah, there's also like the musical leadership, which is enormous and maybe more what's like traditional in the concertmaster job. And so I'm not even talking about it because that feels like a given.
Yeah. So this is your second season, right?
Yes.
So are you in a traditional 10-year path with a concertmaster contract, or is it different in your orchestra? Because I know it depends on the orchestra.
Yeah, exactly. I am on the traditional 10-year track. So I should be finding out fairly soon. In Detroit, the concertmaster is covered in the CBA, in the collective bargaining agreement. And I know that's not the case in many orchestras. So yeah, I am very much part of the team.
Mm-hmm. So you've had, just talking a little bit about the nitty gritty of the tenure process, I assume then it's two seasons in your orchestra?
It's like 18 months. It's like a full calendar year.
Okay. And then how many meetings do you have along the way? Two or three to kind of give you some progress? Okay.
Two. Yeah. Sorry, I said 18 months and then a year, but it's like a full calendar year. So it's like a season and a half. So that's why I call it 18 months. But yeah, a season and a half or a full calendar year.
Yeah, ours is essentially the same, except for that you play a full 2 years, but you find out about 18 months into the process. So that if you don't get tenure, you would still finish out the second year of your contract. And I've seen this happen so many times when people haven't gotten tenure, that in that window between when the orchestra season ends, they've gone and won something else. It's happened more than not, fortunately, because it's a tough situation. You definitely don't want to put people out on the street, but it is a tenure process. And once you make that decision as an orchestra, you're pretty much stuck with that person unless they do something really egregious. So you want to make sure it's a good fit.
Yeah. Right. Absolutely. And I will also say there is an opportunity. So like with the 10-year process, you have these two review meetings and then the committee makes a recommendation. There is an opportunity for an extension of that process to say like, almost, we want to see a little bit more before we make a decision. So that is a possibility.
Yeah, we have the same thing too. And you can accelerate it too in some cases where if you're trying to get early tenure because you have to let another job know that you're not returning, there's opportunity for that too. So there is some flexibility.
Right.
So what advice would you offer to young violinists who are dreaming about becoming a concertmaster?
Soak up all the experiences you can. Do play chamber music. I think a crucial part of being a concertmaster is playing chamber music. I'm constantly playing chamber music in orchestra with, you know, the principal strings, the principal winds. It's about listening to each other, communicating non-verbally. All of those summers at all those chamber music festivals were absolutely essential for me. Learn the orchestral repertoire. This was a whole for me. Don't make my mistakes. Learn the orchestral repertoire. You know, just to like know the excerpts, just to know what you're getting into. Ask for help. When I got serious about taking auditions, I wrote to my teachers because I was still living in Boston where I went to school. And I said, I'm going to do this. Will you help me? And so I played for different people. And sometimes I would like cycle through, you know, I would play for one teacher one week, one teacher the next week, or friends. But I was playing for somebody. I had, quote unquote, a lesson every week. And just that experience of getting up in front of people and playing is something that, especially as a young professional, you kind of get out of the habit of doing.
Yeah.
So that was huge.
And not all violinists, right? Did you play for other instrumentalists too? Because on the committee, you're going to have other instruments too. I try and tell people that.
Yeah.
It's okay to go play for a violinist if you're a cellist, because there's probably going to be a violinist on a committee that you're auditioning for.
Right.
And you want to make sure that what you're doing is translating across your instrument too, to other instruments. Yeah,
absolutely. And then as far as audition experience and audition prep, I think be kind to yourself. The goal can't be to win the audition. The goal has to be to play your best and to do the best you can. I did not go into Detroit expecting to win. Like, I was shocked. My husband was shocked.
Yeah.
Not because I wasn't capable, but because it was really, I was just doing it for experience. And here I am. But for that other audition that I took that I didn't win, I was thrilled. I worked so hard and my playing held up exactly how I expected. And so I walked away feeling like, great, okay, now I know I can do this.
Yeah.
So I wasn't crushed by the fact that I didn't win, because it was like, huh, great, mission accomplished.
Yeah, That's such good advice because you can't control anything else.
No.
You can't control what the committee thinks of you.
No.
You can only control what you put out there. You can't control how anyone else plays.
Nope.
It's just about what you can do. You're competing with yourself, really, to do your best. So that's really great advice. Well, thank you so much for joining us today on the Cello Sherpa podcast.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you so much to Robin Bollinger for joining us today and sharing her story with us. And thank you for listening to another episode of the Cello Sherpa podcast. For more information on Robin and any of the links we spoke about today, check out our show notes by scrolling down on the episode. Be sure and catch our next episode where we interview Jennifer Roig Franco-Lee. She is a prize-winning violinist, healer, and coach for musicians. We talk about her new book, which is coming out on January 7th, Make Great Music with Ease. We're here to serve you, so if you have questions or topic suggestions you would like us to cover in future episodes, please use the contact page on our website, thecellosherpa.com. You will also find information about the specific services we offer on the website. Don't forget to follow us and rate us on whatever platform you get your podcasts. This helps us climb the rankings so other people can find us. Today's episode was edited by Eric Begay at Red House Productions and produced and recorded by me, Joel Dallow.